Our reading tonight from Holy Scripture will all be from the book of Esther and commencing in chapter 2. The book of Esther and chapter 2. We'll have quite a number of extracts to take from this book in our reading. And first of all, verse 5 of Esther chapter 2. Now in Shushan the palace there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jer, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite, who had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captivity which had been carried away with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away, and he brought up Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother, and the maid was fair and beautiful, whom Mordecai, when her father and mother were dead, took for his own daughter. Verse 21, in those days while Mordecai sat in the king's gate, two of the king's chamberlain, Bigthan and Teresh, of those which kept the door, were wroth and sought to lay hand on the king Ahasuerus. And the thing was known to Mordecai, who told it unto Esther the queen, and Esther certified the king thereof in Mordecai's name. And when inquisition was made of the matter, it was found out. Therefore they were both hanged on a tree, and it was written in the book of the Chronicles before the king. After these things did King Ahasuerus promote Haman the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, and advanced him, and set his seat above all the princes that were with him. And all the king's servants that were in the king's gate bowed and reverenced Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai bowed not, nor did him reverence. Then the king's servants which were in the king's gate said unto Mordecai, Why transgressest thou the king's commandment? Now it came to pass, when they spake daily unto him, and he hearkened not unto them, that they told Haman to see whether Mordecai's matters would stand. For he had told them that he was a Jew. Now, you know about the decree for the extermination, the genocide of the race. Chapter 4 and verse 12. And they told to Mordecai Esther's words. Then Mordecai commanded to answer Esther, Think not with thyself that thou shalt escape in the king's house more than all the Jews. For if thou altogether holdest thy peace at this time, then shall their enlargement and deliverance arise to the Jews from another place. But thou and thy father's house shall be destroyed. And who knoweth whether thou art come to the kingdom for such a time as this? And then we know about Esther's intercession. Chapter 6 and verse 1. On that night could not the king sleep, and he commanded to bring the book of the records of the Chronicles, and they were read before the king. And they tell him about Mordecai's preservation of his life. Verse 3. And the king said, What honor and dignity hath been done to Mordecai for this? Then said the king's servants that ministered unto him, There is nothing done for him. The king said, Who is in the court? Now Naaman was come into the outward court of the king's house to speak unto the king to hang Mordecai on the gallows that he had prepared for him. And then Haman comes in verse 6. And the king said unto Haman, What shall be done unto the man whom the king delighteth to honor? Now Haman thought in his heart, To whom would the king delight to do honor more than to myself? And Haman answered the king, For the man whom the king delighteth to honor, Let the royal apparel be brought which the king useth to wear, and the horse that the king rideth upon, and the crown royal which is set upon his head, and let this apparel and horse be delivered to the hand of one of the king's most noble princes, that they may array the man withal whom the king delighteth to honor, and bring him on horseback through the street of the city, and proclaim before him, Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delighteth to honor. Then the king said to Haman, Make haste and take the apparel and the horse, as thou hast said, and do even so to Mordecai the Jew, that sitteth at the king's gate. Let nothing fail of all that thou hast spoken. Now, I think we know the end of that. Chapter 8, just very brief reading now. Chapter 8, verse 1. Verse 2 of chapter 8. And the king took off his ring, which he had taken from Haman, and gave it unto Mordecai. Verse 15, And Mordecai went out from the presence of the king in royal apparel of blue and white, and with a great crown of gold, and with a garment of fine linen and purple, and the city of Shushan rejoiced and was glad. Chapter 9, verse 4, for Mordecai was great in the king's house, and his fame went out throughout all the provinces. For this man, Mordecai, waxed greater and greater. Verse 23, and the Jews undertook to do as they had begun, and as Mordecai had written unto them. And finally, we'll read the three verses of chapter 10. And the king Ahasuerus laid a tribute upon the land and upon the isles of the sea and of all the acts of his power and of his might. And the declaration of the greatness of Mordecai whereunto the king advanced him, are they not written in the book of the chronicles of the kings of Media and Persia? For Mordecai the Jew was next unto king Ahasuerus and great among the Jews and accepted of the multitude of his brethren, seeking the wealth of his people and speaking peace to all his seed. Now, there you are. I've taken up quite a bit of your time and with this reading. And yet, more could have been read, but I trust enough was read to let us get the thread of thought. The subject that is before us in the few nights of the present meetings, as you know, is to take a look at the profile of some of the men of Bible honor. I think it would be practically impossible to spend any few nights considering Bible men of honor and not at some stage in the consideration come to the book of Esther and in particular to the case of this man, Mordecai. Actually, honor, while he is not called an honorable man, he certainly was an honored man. We see him in one of these chapters sitting clad in sackcloth. We turn a few pages, the tables have been completely turned. The same man goes out dressed in the purple of Persia, and the crown upon his head, and the royal sash around his body. And certainly he was accorded tremendous honors. Of course, we remember that not everyone who is honored is honorable. And in the short term, not everyone who is honorable is honored. But it is my presumption that this man was both. He was honored, and he was honorable. There will have been men in the last week, I suppose, and they will have found their address in a particular governmental chamber, the right honorable member. I don't want to cast aspersions upon any of the honorable gentlemen, but many of those men are anything but honorable. They have the honor of office, but not the honor of character. What I say is about Mordecai. He did attain the honor of office eventually. It was denied him for a while. He eventually attained it. But he also carried with him the honor of character. Part of the reason why I emphasize that is because it is by no means a universal opinion. Mordecai has his critics to the present day. I remember not so very long ago, I had in my hand a book and it referred to this man's prejudice. It referred to his biased patriotism. It referred to his blundering brashness. It referred to his pig-headed pride. That was a book that sat on the shelf of a Christian bookshelf in Belfast, written by a highly qualified Bible scholar. So that Mordecai has received the rough end of criticism, even to this present hour. I personally do not think he was perfect, but I certainly do not think that the criticism that I have just mentioned is by any means biblically justified, because what we read of this man, at least in the various stages of this book, it gives us an indication of the quality of his character. He was an honored man. But he was also an honorable man. It's very difficult, especially in the confines of one meeting, to extract his story from the 10 chapters of this book and take it out as an isolated unit. Everything is so much and closely entwined with the fabric of the whole story that we are going to find it very, very difficult to disengage Mordecai from the other personalities in the book. I think it will only be fair if you give me just a few minutes, and I'll only spend a very short time on this because I really want to get to consider the honor of this man's character. But if you can give me a few minutes, I'll try and make a number of general statements that I hope will serve, at least in part, to place the book of Esther in its context. It's a book about God. That, of course, is a most surprising statement. Because the one fact that we were told from we were little ones in Sunday school, the name of God does not appear in the book of Esther. We were often told it was the most godless book in the Bible. So that when I say it is a book about God, it's certainly a statement that needs to be justified. If he's not mentioned, neither by the name Elohim, nor by the covenant name Jehovah, nor by any of those other familiar titles, if he's not mentioned even once in 10 chapters, if nobody prays, if there are no sacrifices offered to him, if there is no reference to the temple, if there is no reference to the law of God, how then can we say that this is a book about God? Well, the first thing I would say about the book of Esther is it gives to us a very, very comforting revelation of divine interest. You see, the people who are involved, Mordecai and Esther and these other people who were involved, immediately involved, they are the people who didn't come back from Babylon. We often hear, and rightly so, about the faithful few who left the luxury of that famous country, wealthy country, and they came back to the ruins of Jerusalem to try and raise a temple for the glory of God. We are told that the most of the people were so comfortable that they stayed. But a faithful few, a remnant, moved out and thrust on God. That is all true. We may say to ourselves then, God will have a deep interest in this few. The pilgrims and the pioneers who step out as a small minority to raise a temple from the rubble of Jerusalem, God will be interested in them, but those carnal, casual people that didn't bother leaving when they had the freedom to leave, he let them go. No, he doesn't let them go. Because the book of Esther is a book that's written about those people. And God is interested in them. And God is caring for them. And God is looking after their destiny, and he's looking after their preservation, even though many of them didn't have heart enough to go back, either with Joshua and Zerubbabel, and they didn't go back either with Ezra. God is interested in them. You know, I'd say this, brethren and sisters, if God only was interested in us, when we were at our spiritual best, it would mean that we would have his interest about one day in 100. And that's a very generous estimate. I'm glad that even when my spirit is low, and when I'm not as dedicated and devoted as I might be, and I do appreciate the verse of that little hymn, though I forget him and wander away, yet doth he love me wherever I stray. And you say, well, that'll make you careless, Gilliland. If he loves you when you stray, it'll make you careless. The hymn writer didn't think that. He said, back to his dear loving arms do I flee when I remember that Jesus loves me. God's interest in his people and in all of his people, I mean his earthly people, is very, very clearly enshrined in this book of Esther. A second thing that I would mention, and this is only very brief in general, Esther not only demonstrates to us God's interest in his people, but it also expresses God's intention for his people. You see, as I've already indicated, the book begins with a Jew in the lowest place. And the book finishes with a Jew in the place of highest exaltation. One of the things that God was teaching throughout the events of the book of Esther, he was teaching the mighty monarch of Persia how much he needed the Jew. Only for this man Mordecai, Ahasuerus would have lost his life. And the Jew was needed. I think that we can say that that is something that God will teach the Gentile nations of the world at large. And before history is finished, God will teach this world universally how much is owed to the Jew. He will never stop until the nation that has been discounted, until the nation which men have conspired to exterminate, until that nation has a place at the head of the nations, not the tail. You know, the Hamans, and the Herods, and the Hitlers, and the Husseins have all joined to blot out the name of the Jews. Not one of them has been successful yet. The little horn in the future will make another attempt. Neither will he be successful, for it is God's mind to bring the Jew to the position of universal government. His intention. I like those words. You have heard it umpteen times, but just let me refer to it very, very briefly. I love the expressions, the sentiments, and the courage of Benjamin Disraeli. On one occasion in Parliament, when a toppy-nosed Englishman made a disparaging remark about Disraeli's Jewishness, little Disraeli took a breath and he pulled himself up to his tallest height. And with the eloquence that he could command, he said, "Sir," he said, "you accuse me of being a Jew. I am proud to answer to the name." He said, "Let me remind you that the half of Christendom worships a Jew, and the other half a Jewess. And may I also remind you that when my forefathers were worshipping the living and true God," he said, "your forefathers were naked savages eating acorns in the woods of Britain. The world thinks it can do without the Jew. But dear brethren and sisters, God has a destiny for that nation, and he will turn the tables until that nation has eventually arrived at the place of his appointment." Divine interest, divine intention for the Jew, Mordecai the Jew, we'll be looking at that just in a couple of minutes. I'm going to roll these two into one just to keep moving on with the clock. You know, a great feature of the book of Esther is divine intervention and divine invisibility. God intervening in the smaller circumstances of life, not in a miraculous way, almost, and I don't want to be misunderstood in this, almost in a coincidental way. I would be happy to preach a message sometime on the coincidences of Esther. When I say coincidence, I'm talking about divine coincidence. I'm not talking about things that happen just haphazardly and at random. I'm talking about two events that seem to be poles apart, and they begin to move at a great distance, and they move until at last they meet at a point of intersection, and they coincide. And the precision that brings them together is so amazing that you're compelled to confess there's no one but a divine planner could have operated such a coinciding. God's unseen. I may say in the book of Exodus, God is publicly absent, but he's providentially present. There isn't any dividing of the sea. There isn't any raining of the manna from the sky. There isn't any splitting of the rock and the flowing of the waters. The great day of miracles is past. But you see, the people in the book of Esther were just like ourselves. They were allowed to see the hand of God in the texture of life circumstances. bringing things together. Every Christian in this meeting, even a number of years saved, you can cast a look across the landscape of your life and you can see things that were brought together. You didn't understand them at the time. When they happened, you were greatly puzzled. But now, with the benefit of hindsight, you can see that things were all being guided by the hand of a God who was in perfect control. He intervened. He allowed people to meet. He allowed certain dates to be set. He allowed certain promotions to take place. He allowed certain people to get certain jobs at a certain time. And when God's time for them to be in that job was over, they were deposed. You see all that in Exodus. There were no roofs lifted off. There were no earthquakes. But the providence of God in this book is so compelling that even though there's not an earthquake, it is absolutely earth-moving. You know, can I say to all the Christians here tonight, now you get this firmly fixed in your mind if you can, because it will stand you in good stead in very, very difficult days. Maybe there's some Christian here tonight and you cannot understand why things have happened as they've happened with your health, with your family, with your business, your employment. You cannot understand what is happening. Listen, dear Christian. You will have to come to a point. This is not sentiment. This is not fluff or floss. This is faith. You will have to come to a point in all those perplexing problems of life that defy a human answer, that the God who gave the galaxy, that the God who is the architect of the ages, that the God who is the planner of the periods, and the God whose hand is firmly on the helm of history, the God who guides all of that and governs all of that, he will make no mistake in the small minutiae of your life. And the devil will do his best. When those problems come, the devil will do his diabolical best, or if you like, his diabolical worst, to try and undermine within your soul the confidence in the invisible God who intervened. Let me say what I said already. When God is externally invisible, he can be providentially very, very close. And that's seen in the book of Esther. Not only divine intentions, divine interest, divine invisibility, divine intervention in the normal affairs of life. But in this book, and this brings me immediately now to Mordecai, we have divine instruction given to us in five illustrations. There are five major personalities. You see, it's a great thing to look at the stories of the Bible. I love a story. That's why all you folks love to come to a report meeting. You like to hear stories. All the ingredients of a good story are here. I'm speaking now from the standpoint of literature and then supremely of biblical literature. You get characterization. You get plot. Irony. Satire. Humor. Suspense. Disappointment. Climax. You get it all here, just set out so beautifully and intertwined in the book of Esther. The other book is the very same that carries the lady's name, the book of Ruth. We've heard 100 times that the two books are very, very much compatible, but they move in two different directions in the sense that the book of Ruth is telling us about a Gentile lady brought in amongst the Jews or Israel. The book of Esther is telling us about a Jewess lady, and she's brought in amongst the Gentiles. While the two books have much in common, they move in a different area. You know, one of the beautiful features of the book of Ruth is just the rustic background. I love to read Ruth. You can see the waving fields of barley. You can see the girl threshing wheat. You can see the master of the field sleeping quietly beside the winnowed grain. You see the simple ceremonies at the gate of the rustic village of Bethlehem. It's all so refreshing. The fields of Moab and the fields of Judah. There's a rustic feature about the book of Ruth. You see, when you get to Esther, it's nothing like that. It's all royal. And it's palaces. And it's king. And it's beauty parade. And it's big party. And it's high ranking job. And it's political intrigue. So that while the two books are quite compatible in some sense, they stand very much in contrast one to another. And I'm very glad to put them both together and know that whether I live in a simple village like Bethlehem, or whether I move in circles that are at the very highest level of society, the God whom we trust is the God who is in supreme control at both levels. He cannot be outwitted or evaded. Now, of the five characters, I'll mention the five, but I'll not tell you anything about them. That would only take me away down another avenue. Ahasuerus the worldling. Vashti, his wife, his first wife. Vashti, the willful. You know what she did? She didn't do what her husband told her, and the whole empire nearly ground to a halt. Just because she didn't do what her husband told her. It was so unusual in those days for a lady not to do what her husband told her. The whole empire was in consternation. I know it has never happened in this meeting. It has never happened in the present company that a lady wouldn't do what her husband tells her. But it happened here, and it brought a handbrake into the whole empire, and she was a very, very foolish lady, and it had serious repercussions. And if you ladies don't do what your husband tells you, you never know what the outcome might be. But she was willful. She had a mind of her own. I don't know if she has any descendants, but, well, she did have a mind of her own. And I better move on from that. Ahasuerus, he was a weak man. He was a worldly man. He was a big fool. A big fool. And I'm backtracking again. When I read a character like this got the biggest job in the world at that time, I scratch my head. If I didn't know something about the history of Great Britain and America, I would still be wondering. He didn't seem to know what he was doing. It was always other people made his decisions. He was wafting about just with the wind of every opinion, an exceedingly weak and worldly man. And yet he has a position as the emperor of 127 provinces. How did such a man get to the top? Well, I suppose the world has never really changed, because you take a look at some of the people who are honored and you wonder how they got there. And there's a man who's honorable and he's at the bottom of the pile. And a man who's totally dishonorable and he's at the top of the pinnacle. And you say, where is righteousness? What is really happening here? Things are totally disordered. God says, I know they are. He says, but give me half a dozen years. And he says, I'll reverse things. And he says, the man that's at the bottom of the pile, the honorable man, he said, I'll bring him up to level. And the whole world will see exactly what true character really consists of. Then, of course, we have Esther. Esther the wise. We have Haman the wicked. And we have Mordecai the worthy. Now let me get into this man Mordecai. I've already said something about his career, as we have mentioned the importance of his background and his patriotism. That'll do for the first. Actually, when he's introduced, he doesn't come into the book, strangely enough, and there's a reason for this that I don't take time with just now, but he doesn't come into the book until the middle of, or at least the early part of chapter 2. And when we're first introduced to him, in chapter 2 it says, in Shushan the palace, there was a certain Jew, whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jer, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish of Benjamin. You know, here's an identity crisis. You say, what do you mean an identity crisis? Well, this is quite a thing now. You have a man living in what we now call Iran, Susa, there's a heap of ruin. Beneath the dust of time that has accumulated in Iran, there once was a glorious palace. They have scraped back some of the dust, and it has all faded. That's what always happens to worldly glory. But here's a man, and he lives in a Persian palace city. I'm not saying he lived in the palace, but he lived in the palace city. He has Jewish blood flowing in his veins, and he has a Persian name. And he's working for a Persian boss. Now you say there's a bit of tension here. The very first time that he's introduced, it says, now in Shushan the palace, there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai. Before we even get his name, we are first of all reminded about his nationality. Now let me repeat what I said so that we'll get the picture fairly clear. And this is this man. This man is very first introduction. He's in a Persian city. He's working for a Persian boss. He's called by a Persian name. But he himself is a Jew. So that if you live in a Persian city, if you have a Persian name, if you're employed by a Persian boss, you have to accept the Persian lifestyle. Oh, but I'm a Jew. Where he is, and what he is, are at loggerheads. He's here in Susa, in the land of ancient Persia, but in his heart and in his soul and in his bloodline, he really belongs to another country. Physically, this man is located every day of his life amongst the heathen, but spiritually, he belongs to another people. I know that I'm speaking tonight to an audience, and that's exactly your situation. Some of you have spent this day in a worldly office. You maybe bear a title that has been given by the world. Not blaming you for that. You eke out your living in a piece of worldly employment. You're surrounded by the ethos of people who have bought into this world system. But the problem is, you're a Christian. There's a recipe for bother. You're there on Monday and on Tuesday and on Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. But you have a birth that links you with another country. The royal blood of heaven is flowing within your spiritual veins. And as soon as we are introduced to this man, we are told that here's a man and he's living here. But he really belongs to that other country. You're living it. You belong to heaven. I live in Dollingstown, but I belong to heaven. There's a disagreement. There's a paradox. There's a tension. There's a pull. And we get his name. And we get his nationality. We get all about his connections. He has a clean birthright. He goes right back to Saul. Right back to the royal house. Oh, there have been problems. He has a history behind him, this man. He stands on the receiving end of a great line of history and a great heritage. Mind you, we have some history behind us. You see, all you Christians here tonight, myself included, there's none of us at the start of the line. Here's a man and he's well down the line of history. But I tell you, I know what Saul was. I'll be speaking about him perhaps on another night. I know all that. But at the start of the line of this man's history, there was a man whose head received the anointing oil, the first king of Israel. And history has moved on, generations have passed. Here's a we're not the beginning of it, but I can tell you, the line in which we stand tonight, mind you, it had some beginning. I could go back to the start of our line, and I could point out a man like, I think he had a name of Paul. And there's another fellow somewhere away back near the start of our spiritual genealogy. I think he was called Peter. And there's another man was called John. And here's a man, and he lives down in Babylon, and he works for Ahasuerus. And there are big names. I tell you, there are some big names. You look at some of the names that are associated with this Persian court. They're real jawbreakers. And the titles. And the protocol. And the pageantry. And the paraphernalia. And the show and the sham. And the superficiality. That all these Barbie doll parties and all this kind of thing. It was all made up for parties and show. Here's a man in the middle of it all with the big names. But he remembers the names that lie at the start of his history. And he says, my heritage that goes back to there, he says, it has given me the name of a Jew. Well, this man has honor. You talk about honor. This is honor that's to be remembered. That's why I told you that story, reminded you about Benjamin Disraeli standing up in an English parliament, and he said with pride, he said, you accuse me of being a Jew. He said, I'm proud to take the name. You know, young believer here tonight, can I say to you, wherever you work, whether it's a carpenter shop or whether it's a carpeted office, you should always be proud to take the name of Christian. It links you with heaven. It links you with the noblest man that ever graced the soil of planet Earth. It links you with glory. It gives you a connection with another country and with the glorious Christ himself. What a line of history and heritage. This is honor to be carried. And here's a man, and in the midst of his Persian surroundings, he is not prepared to forget his Jewish roots. He remembers the honor of being linked with such a people. Of course, I don't read anything about his wife. I don't read anything about his children. There was an unfortunate thing happened. He had a cousin. Very beautiful girl. The unfortunate thing that happened was this. Both her parents died when she was very young. Oh. He's a Jew. She's a Jewess. She belongs to the same family. You know what he does? The Bible says he took her into his own house and he looked after her as though she were his own daughter. Presumably he was a good bit older. I think old enough to be her father. We could maybe guess that, but I'll not go into details. Well, you see now, I tell you, that's going to be a fix. And now here's a man, look, he has to care for this orphan girl. It's not an awful handicap. Won't that exert an awful limitation in his life? Just look at the things that he could do. And just look at the places where he could go. And think about the achievements which he could accomplish if he didn't have the commitment. Why did he ever take that on? I know you say it was a family responsibility and it was a good and a godly thing to do and he wanted to protect this girl from some of those pernicious influences of Persia that were around her. And I think he did his job well because when she stepped into the court, she seemed to come out unscathed. You say, I know he had the duty, but it's awful. It's awfully confining to him. It's nice to be compassionate and careful. You know, there might be someone here tonight, and circumstances in your life, maybe it's a bereavement, maybe it's an illness, just as this girl lost her parents. Maybe circumstances in your life have necessitated that you commit yourself to a life of caring. You look at other people, they have no commitment. And you're left to look after a sick relative or someone that's limited and is holding you back and holding you down. You never thought it would come your way, but it has arrived now and you feel it a little bit burdensome and cramping. You know, when he took this little girl into his home, it never crossed his mind that one day this very girl, it will be her services that will bring me to the highest place in Persia. And what seemed to be an obstacle, in the gracious providence of God, it was later to be an unparalleled opportunity. Sometimes what we think is a crippling thing. Oh, I tell you, Christians, you know, we're living in an age where everybody loves his freedom. And we like to fly about and we like to move about and we don't like anything to hold us down, and I'm just the same. But people get old and other people are young, and there are those things in life which care and compassion demands. We don't ask for them, but they come. This man didn't ask for the death of his uncle and aunt, but it came. Left him with an orphan girl, and yet that very thing became a catalyst for unspeakable, incredible blessing down the line. I'm sure the day she brought him in and sat him down on the couch of the royal chambers, he thought about the day that he sat her down in his little chamber and wondered what will happen now. Dear friend, I can do nothing better now than quote Cowper's great hymn, God moves in a mysterious way.
His wonders to perform, he plants his footsteps in the sea and rides upon the storm.
I say that marvelous word, providence, God's gracious providence, it's stamped across every page of Esther and a good deal of the other parts of the Bible beside. Well, I'll move on from that. The next glimpse that we are given into this man of honor, not only honor remembered, he remembered the honor of being a Jew. I want to speak about honor being registered. Now, he's working for the king of Persia. I've already given you a little snapshot of the character of Ahasuerus, a rather unscrupulous, selfish man. Any of you people work for a difficult boss? Well, Mordecai hears that there are two boys going to pension him off. You see, once you move into high circles in this world, things become very vicious. Young brethren, I'm not trying to chill your worldly ambition. I don't want to injure your ideal, but I would like to put into your heart some degree of realism. You see, the big jobs in the societies of earth, they're only big in name, they're really not big in nature. The higher you go, the more people you have gunning for you. And here's Ahasuerus, two of his doorkeepers. These weren't boys that lived away across in the far-flung part of the empire. Two of the doorkeepers of his palace, they were going to assassinate him. Mordecai hears about it. Mordecai is honorable enough to tell the right channel so that the word gets to this very, very awkward boss. He's actually the man that has taken Esther from him, because Ahasuerus took Esther into his harem, and that's the part of the story that I'm stepping over tonight. But despite all that, no malice. I think, you know, if you had been speaking to Ahasuerus, at least later on he knew it, if he didn't know it at this time, Mordecai was one of the most reliable employees he had. Here's a man, and he's going to protect the interests of the king. That's how Joseph behaved with Pharaoh. That's how Daniel behaved with Nebuchadnezzar and some of the other. This is how Mordecai behaved with Ahasuerus. You know why he was so careful? Because he had the name of a Jew. And he said, even though I'm a Jew working for a Gentile, he says, I don't want to do anything that would in any way tarnish the nobility of this name. We often hear it said, and I just repeat it, you know, a Christian should be the best employee that any man has. He might be awkward. He might be froward. He might be unscrupulous and all that. But can I encourage you, take a leaf from this man's book. He never allowed the awkwardness of the man at the top. And he never used that as an excuse for doing something that was less than honorable himself. Took a note of it. His honorable action was registered. It wasn't rewarded just now. It was they put it down in the log book. You know, everything has to be logged. Things haven't changed very much. But there they have it down. His honor was remembered. I'm a Jew with a great heritage. His honor is now registered. He has protected and preserved the life of the king. Well, you say, that's the end of chapter 2. You say, I know what's going to really happen now. You say, I know. That's the end of chapter 2 where Mordecai has done this honorable thing. You say, I can anticipate it. As soon as you hit chapter 3, it's going to say, after these things, Mordecai got promotion. Not a word of it. You know how chapter 3 begins? It says, after these things, Ahasuerus promoted Haman.
What?
The man who turned out to be the biggest rascal in the whole plot, he got promotion. And the man who preserved the king's life and did what was true and upright, he was just left sitting. Brethren, I only whisper this, but I have to tell you this, because corporate life in our day is very difficult. Always remember that not only is this old world very unclean, but you always remember it's very unfair. Now, if you've got promotion, that's fine. That's fine. And if you've got promotion, I'm not saying you've got it because you're just like them. Sometimes a Christian does get promotion, recognition of his character. We'll see the principle later on. But more often than not, the man that's righteous is left sitting. And the people who are unworthy, taken by the hand and carried to the top. Everybody has to bow. So you say now, that recipe that you mentioned for trouble a while ago is really coming to a head now. Everybody has to bow with reverence. You notice that word. It's the idea of worship. Everybody has to bow with worship to this man, Haman. But there's a man, Mordecai, now. He's in a real problem. Quite a lot has happened until now. And he has gone in with it. He didn't stop them taking Esther. I don't think he liked the business, but he didn't change his name. I'm not sure that he particularly liked the name that was linked with the Babylonian god Marduk. Because Mordecai comes from Marduk. He didn't change. There's quite a lot has happened, and he doesn't seem to have flinched, but there's something happened now, and he has to take a stand. Why? What is there about this point that has been reached where Mordecai says, now, I haven't raised any objection. I haven't in any way been controversial, but this is a point of no return. The boys came out and asked, he said, Mordecai, you'll get into trouble now. You'll get into trouble. What's wrong? You better do this every day.
Every day they came out and told him, you better bow down, you better bend now, if you don't bend.
When everybody else had bent, this man was standing like a pillar.
See, now listen, Haman will get you. And they kept at him every day, and they kept him. And you know what the Bible says? The Bible says he had told them,
I don't like that boy. I don't like my new boss.
I just can't get on with him. It's a personality clash.
No, it wasn't a personality clash. That book that I was telling you about, Mordecai's pig-headed pride, that's what he thought it was.
A personality clash.
No. No. It was a matter of principle.
And Mordecai knew, if I bow to this man, and if I give my worship to this human being, there's going to be something take place that will be the compromise
of my Jewishness. For he says, as a Jew, thou shalt have no other gods before me.
He said, it's the easy way out.
You say, now come on, Mordecai. Now come on, sir. You can't be stiff and you can't be stubborn. You need to blend fidelity and flexibility. That's a mouthful of postmodernism.
You need to blend fidelity. And after all, now, boy, I tell you, sure, that's a way back. Sure, that's a way.
Look at how many years ago that is. And that's, you're nowhere near Judah.
Don't be calling yourself a Jew linked with Judah. You're nowhere near Judah. When you're out of the country, and when you're out of the place, and you're away amongst these other people, don't still call yourself a man from Judah.
Forget about the whole business, and just bend and blend. Some of you brethren will find yourself right there someday. You'll find yourself with a new boss.
He mightn't be so easy to get on with,
but that'll not be the problem. The problem will be when he comes to ask you to do something that is a compromise, not of your Jewishness, it's a compromise of your Christianity. Some of you girls will come up against it.
And when you're just there in the crucible of choice, and when you're there at the crossroads of decision,
you see, people talk about the fact that we make decisions. No. That's not the way to look at it. Can I say to every young Christian, especially in this meeting, and I want you all to listen, those particularly who have their life before them, and you've been making choices, some of you have been making choices about employment, some of you have been making choices about courtship, some of you have been making other choices in life that will have far-reaching effects, and when you make those choices, I plead with you in God's name, never make a choice that compromises your Christianity.
I say, people say, we make choices.
That's not the point. The point is that it's our decisions that make us. As I stand before you folks tonight, I'm the sum total. I am the sum total. It's not a big total, I'll admit, but I'm the sum total of the choices that I made from the 24th of June, 1970. I made a choice that night. I have no notion of going back on it. I've made one or two choices in the intervening years I'm so happy about. I've made one or two others that cost me a good little bit.
And what I am tonight, it's not us making the decisions, it's the decisions make us.
And here's a man, and he says, now I'm going to have to either be a Persian or a Jew. It's a clash of worldviews. You see, the man that's involved here is an Amalekite, an Agagite. It's a clash of worldviews.
Here's a man, and he's a Jew. What is a Jew's ideal world? What's the ideal world of a Jew?
It It's a world where there are no Amalekites.
What's the ideal world of an Amalekite?
It's a world where there are no Jews.
So here are two men, and they're moving with different agendas, and there's bound to be a clash.
I tell you, folks, let us just get this. You go into a heathen employer, an educated man, big business, 10-year program, everything set out, nothing going to stop him. He has no thought of God or anything like that. What is his worldview? His worldview is a world where Christ means nothing. What is your worldview? Your worldview is a world where Christ is everything.
What is his worldview?
You say, I can't work overtime, sir. I'm very sorry. I'll work on Saturday morning, but listen, I'm really sorry. We have, in the church, in the assembly, we have a prayer meeting on Thursday night, and I can't work. And he just laughed out in your face. Perfect. Sure nobody prays now. We don't need to pray. We have got science. We don't need God. We have got science. All we need is formula. We don't need to pray and faith and all that nonsense. He just laughs at, and you feel like just a shriveled shrimp. And you're about to bend. Mordecai, it says they came every day to see if Mordecai's matters would stop. And thank God they did stop. Because here's a man of conviction. When the new boss wants him to compromise his identity, oh, I better stop. People get tired. I'll have to stop. All I'll say is this. The whole thing reversed. You know, there came a day when his fidelity was answered. It was compensated. The king said, who has honored this man for what he has done? They said, nobody. His honor had been denied. But let me, there's a wee verse in the Bible that Mordecai learned as a boy, and it said, them that honor me, I will honor. The king of Persia didn't do it. But God said, I'll do it. And the God of heaven took the sleep from the king of Persia, and he made him read the annals of the kingdom like a boy's storybook one night. Until God found, and the very next morning Haman was coming in to get Mordecai. Oh, you say, boys, it was near shave. A near shave. You see, the next morning Mordecai was, he had the gallows and all built, while old Ahasuerus couldn't sleep and was reading the storybook. The fellows were putting the final nails into the 75-foot gallows. Oh, you see, boys, getting near. We better watch here. We better watch. God's going to allow the thing to slip if he does. God was just sitting on the throne of heaven. He says, it's just time now. It's time now to get this man honored for what they missed. And God will do it. And Haman will be on the gallows. Mordecai will be on the horse. The man whom the king delights to honor. You know, I can just see when, I love that little part. It's the real, it's the humor of the story. When he comes in, the man that the king delights to honor. Haman says that four times. You know, it rumbled around in his mouth. And every time the saliva just drooled from him. The man whom the king delights to honor. He says, who could that be? Only me. And he says, this is what should be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. And he said, put this on him and that on him. The man whom the king delights to honor. And four times he used it. Because it just got sweeter every time. Oh, this honor business. And then the king says, Mordecai, I tell you, if ever a man was sick, if ever you saw a man that you thought had taken a heart attack, if you had met him that day going home to his wife, and he got through the door, she says, what's wrong, dear? Zerah, she was called. She wasn't a good one either. We'll not talk about her tonight. What's wrong? Well, she says, is that child of Mordecai? She says, he wouldn't even bow when I was coming home there. He wouldn't even bend. And he says, the king has told me to do this. Well, there it is. I better not go on. But Mordecai is honored because he honored God. Younger Christian, you do not compromise your Christian identity. We are living in a world where it's a most unpopular thing to be a biblical Christian.
The whole idea is to get people in places of public employment to then, oh, take the drink. Take the drink. It won't do you any harm. Don't be the odd person out. Join the club. Come to the party. Don't let those people in the gospel hall dictate to you who your relationship should be. Make your date
with this educated girl. Don't let those people inhibit your life. That's the way they talk. That's the way they think. You remember, young Christian, it's not the people in the gospel hall inhibit your life. It's the Bible.
It's God. And if God says it, it doesn't matter if the emperor of Persia denies it.
We know exactly where our loyalties ought to lie. And may God help us not to bend. When he got promotion, you say, well, now the big test comes when he really got promotion. And the king gave him a ring. As far as the king was concerned, he had the ring.
It says he went out into the city in blue and purple. As far as the city was concerned, he was decorated with Persian
honors.
As far as the 127 provinces were concerned, his name was known worldwide.
And as far as the Jewish brethren were concerned, he wrote a letter to every one of them, and the Bible says they did what they did because he said it. You talk about honor. A few weeks before, he was sitting in sackcloth. Honors.
You talk about tables being turned.
I tell you, let us go away at least from the meeting if we haven't caught all the details. But dear brethren, let us go away remembering that our God is still on the throne. And he will remember his own. But you say when he got to the top, I knew what happened. The dizzy heights
of Persian promotion.
He wasn't there too long until he forgot all about those Jewish boys. It's all right when he was at the bottom of the pile worrying about them, but now he's light years above them. Forget.
The world has carried him away, and he has now forgotten his association and affinity with the beleaguered people of the Jews, God's people.
You know, the very last verse of the book of Esther tells us this. It speaks about the greatness of Mordecai. It talks about his fame throughout all the provinces. And it says there he was in that elevated height of honor. And you know what the main thing in his heart still was? The welfare of his brethren. He sought the welfare of his brethren. And he was speaking peace to all his seed. He said, there's a people that I still love. He said, the glory and the grandeur of the Persian court, it hasn't erased from my soul the greatness of this people. I have noticed, thank God, it's not universally true. I have noticed some men, and when they were here, they never missed a meeting. They put the interest and the welfare of the people of God, despised and poor though they may be, they put them first. But you see, when they got there, upper management, BMW, Mercedes, Malone Road material, when they got there, their affinity with the saints seemed to wither. Here's a man and his honors. He carried them well because he still remembered where his priorities were and he still remembered where his prospects were. There's nothing wrong with them on the road. There's nothing wrong with the Mercedes. Hope it keeps going. Just the only problem is when you have to get a service. It's a little bit painful. But nevertheless, keep motoring, but never forget God's people, because there's not a people on earth like them. God can preserve his people, and God can promote his people. I'll tell you, brethren, this is the secret of it all. I have to stop. Mordecai promoted God in a heathen pagan court, and God promoted Mordecai when everybody was against him. And if you put God first, even though the legions of hell should line up against you, when the next if God wants to promote you, you'll be there. We can put our trust in God, because God's purpose can never be thwarted, and God's people can never be annihilated. It's no wonder to me that when they gathered up the scraped up the remains in Auschwitz, Dachau, and Belsen, it was just amazing how many of those poor creatures, driven to their death, they had scribbled out on bits of paper the whole book of Esther that learned it by heart. You know, it stood them in good stead in the crucible of life in the concentration camps. When times are tough, the most godless book in the Bible is a great comfort to God's people. I hope our hearts will be comforted by it tonight.